Okay. All right, we're continuing now in this first chapter of Haggai. We look at the instruction of the people. Verses 7 through 11. The direct exhortation here from Haggai that it is time to rebuild. Now, they're told to go and get the wood for building the house. But significantly, there's nothing said about stone here. But when you go to Ezra, same reference to this would indicate that they built with stone and wood. And the suggestion is that there was probably plenty of stone still lying around from the original temple, that they would not have carted all of that off, that it was still there readily available. So all they had to do was to get additional wood. Okay. Twofold result of the building: the pleasure of God as opposed to his earlier displeasure, and the glory of God. The return of that which had departed in terms of God's glory. So the rebuilding of the temple, this was the place where God, again, was the Shekinah glory had been earlier. We had the departure of that, which is referenced in Ezekiel. And now God promises his notice in verse 8, I will take pleasure in it, and I will be glorified, saith the Lord. So, and ultimately, this is the place of future glory that we have in the promises and expectations there. Direct cause and effect relationship between the neglect of God's priorities and their present situation. And specifically, he says, notice what he says, I did blow on it. When ye brought it home, you looked for much, and it came to little, and when you brought it home, I did blow upon it. Why? Because of mine house that is waste, and ye run every man into his own house. If you'll wait just 1 second here, we will get this wrapping off. And I was doing this one day in class. The paper was getting stuck, and I was taking about half the class trying to get this undone or whatever as I was still going on. And eventually some student, you know, pulled out and tossed me a fresh one. So, success. Ah, there we go. Sorry. Thank you. Thank you. The little trials. Okay. Well. Note what God says here. What did he do in verses 10 and 11? He called for a drought on the land. The corn failed, new wine, oil, all of these things. Notice they were natural disasters. They were natural disasters. How do we know that this was being done specifically in terms to send a message to those who were there in Judah? Because God tells us it was. It's just exactly like what we've seen. I can't tell you how many messages, how many times I heard people making reference to the tragedy that happened in New York, the planes flying into the World Trade Center, and then make specific pronouncements that this is God doing this, the judgment on America for its wickedness, etc., etc. It may be. I don't know. But how do I know what this was? Because God tells me. That's how I know. Otherwise, I don't. There are lots of things that God does that I don't know that that is directly the hand of God, and that that's just because of a particular wickedness or something that is wrong or judgment that's coming. And the way the people that looked at Sodom and Gomorrah, those in the neighboring cities, said, oh, what an awful thing happened, that comet that collided there and came down and crashed down on those two cities. Wasn't that a terrible tragedy? Well, that's the way they saw it. Was a natural. They saw it as something naturally taking place and happening. How do we know what happened? God rained down fire from heaven upon them. And we know what it was, and we know why it happened, because specifically God tells us in His Word. I just think it is very important, this is the second time I've said it, because I guess I'm just seeing a lot of it today, that I think it is very important that we don't go beyond the book. And when the book tells us that this is what God is doing, then fine. Right? But when it doesn't, be careful about making pronouncements in the name of God about things that God hasn't said. You know, that's all I'm asking. Notice the response of God's people here. Okay. Verses 12 through 15. This is beautiful. Response of ruler, priest, and people. Unified response. A oneness of heart and mind. In other words, Haggai comes and Haggai says, we need to build. And the response is, yes, that's right. We need to do that. It's not just in one segment, it's across the board. So a complete unified response. So it's almost, I'm reminded of Jacob. Remember all those years that Jacob had promised to any of the, you know, God, if you will watch over me and bring me back and all of this, and I will go back to Bethel. And he doesn't. And he's got, you know, his wives, they've got their idols, they've got all of this. And finally, Jacob says, okay, put away your idols, get rid of all of this, we're going to Bethel. And it's almost as if they, yes, you know, a freshness is there when Jacob decides, I'm going to do the right thing here. And you find this with this, when Haggai gives the message of the Lord, there is this response among the people. They recognize the voice of God in the message of Haggai. Now please, don't get me wrong here. I'm not suggesting that, you know, when you are preaching on Sunday or somebody else, everybody else just, you know, do exactly what you're saying because now I am the voice of God. No, I'm not a prophet. And you're not either. Okay? Here's the voice of God. Right here. That's in here. It's not my words. It's in this book. So let's be sure of what the voice of God is. But when the voice of God, they received the voice of God from God's prophet. And it was the voice of God. They recognized it and they acted upon it. Threefold motivation for that. The fear of God through His judgments. In other words, He was demonstrating this. The judgments had already come. The problems were there. Their crops had failed. Other things hadn't gone right. Economy was not good. The promise of God to be with them. So there's a positive dimension of this as well, of what is going to take place. And then third, what I think is tremendous, if you'll notice in verse 14, and the spirit of all the remnant of the people, and they came and... Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm missing what I'm looking for. Oh, verse 14, the beginning. And the Lord stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and the spirit of Joshua, the son of Josedek, the high priest, and the spirit of all the remnant of the people, and they came and did work in the house of the Lord of hosts, their God. Okay. Haggai preached the message. God stirred up their spirit. It wasn't a 3-day seminar on how do we get people involved. Okay. Now, nothing wrong with encouraging people to get involved and not... Again, I'm not suggesting that. But it wasn't just a mechanical process that, okay, once we get somebody here, then we put them to doing this, get them doing that, so that way get them going and get them involved. Yeah. God stirred their spirit. There is a responsiveness of the Word of God and their own heart. It touched them. It changed something inside of them to make them want to respond and do the right thing. Okay? And that's when the work of God gets done. And too many times, we try to stir up revivals. We try to stir up all of these things. God has got to bring it about. Proclamation of the Word of God, which is what Haggai was doing. And then looking to the Spirit of God to do His work in our midst. And when all of those, when that comes together, then the work of God is going to get done. And that's what happens with Haggai. In 23 days, notice we have here, it's the 4th and 20th day of the 6th month, and we started on the first day of the month. 23 days after he starts preaching, we got action. Now, you know, we say, well, why was the next day? Well, there may have been a few other things. Somebody might say, "You know, wait a minute. I got to get this set aside here. I got to finish what I'm doing right here. Then we'll get to it." But in less than a month, they're underway. I think that's pretty good. You know, 23 days from the time he starts preaching, they're underway rebuilding the temple, and it doesn't stop until it gets done. I think that's good. There is a considerable discussion about the placement of this particular date in verse 15. And when I say considerable, I mean considerable. And I am not going to get into all the intricacies of this date. It's just because, again, most of the messages all start with a date. And so, notice, this one comes at the end in verse 15. And you obviously have a message starting at the beginning of chapter 2 in verse 1 from the context and the structure of it. So a lot of people have problems. What do we do with this? Should verse 15 of chapter 1 be a part of the beginning of chapter 2? Does it belong later in chapter 2? There are a lot of people who want to move it around all over the place. But the best ones that I read said, ultimately, bottom line, leave it alone. It works where it is. Leave it where it is. But as I said, there is a lot of discussion about whether that is there. And I think it doesn't trouble me, but apparently it did a lot of people. And just putting it there, it seems to come at the end of that, puts the cap on it and says, here's when we started the work, in essence. The glory to come. And here in chapter 2, a reminder of the past. And notice the date for this one, the seventh month, the 1 20th day of the month, came the word of the Lord by the prophet Haggai. Notice once again, this is October 17, 520. Okay. Seventh day of the Feast of Tabernacles, it is exactly 440 years earlier that Solomon had dedicated his temple. Now, this one is not completed. They're in process. And so consequently, some come to look at it, and they make a comparison to the earlier temple. And it's painful. And verse 3, it talks to us about, how do you see it now? Is it not in your eyes in comparison of it as nothing? Okay. Not like Solomon's temple, folks. Solomon's temple was magnificent. People came from everywhere to want to see this. The grandeur of Solomon, that's not what we have here. And those who have turned... Whoops. All right. I don't know what I did. Okay. Must have interacted with the speakers on that computer there, I guess. Okay. Okay. We got it. Those who had returned and who had seen Solomon's temple at an earlier time, this was nowhere close. And so it really tempered their joy, because they remembered what it could be. But again, it's not the day of Solomon. It's not Solomon's day. It's a remnant. It's a handful. This is not a time when Judah is a major player on world affairs. It is a different day altogether. But God is still at work. Not grand, not spectacular, not going to be noted by everybody in the world, but it is God's doing. He wanted them there. He wanted them building. He wanted the temple rebuilt. And that's what they were doing. It was God's plan. It was God's purpose. It was God's direction. And it wasn't spectacular, but it was what His plan was for them at that point. And it's going to result in something spectacular. It's part of that continuous process. So, don't be discouraged. I think that's the best note for all of us. Yes?
May I ask, I'm sure this is appropriate type of question.
I'll direct it to my friend back here. Okay.
Yeah. In Jeremiah, it says the glory of His present house will be greater than the glory of His former house.
Mm-hmm.
From there, I understood that this is also a magnificent building. But perhaps it has nothing to do with the outer appearance of the temple.
Well, I think verse 9, he's making reference there to the future temple that's going to be built during the time of Christ. I think that's his reference, because there he's talking about he's going to shake all nations and the desire will come and they're going to fill this house with glory. And it's a bit of a double prophecy there, but I think the thrust of it is the future temple that's going to be built, the great glory. Okay. Am I close there? Okay, good. Just a sec. Thanks. So I think just the lesson for us in that, don't be discouraged. Sometimes we're small groups. We look about. We see things about us. We see Islam growing at an enormous rate and with power. We see other religious groups that seem to have a lot of dynamism and things are happening there. But the Lord is at work in this place, and He can be at work in our midst in a small group. It's not the same as it's what you've got here, that the Lord was there. It wasn't spectacular. Yeah. The outlook for the future, well, it mentions the presence of the Lord there in 2, 4, and 5. And then the exhortation to courage and the reminder of similar exhortations in the past in verses 4 and 5. Well, they look at this somewhat discouraged, and the response here is, "Be strong, O Zerubbabel, saith the Lord, and be strong, Joshua, and be strong, all ye people of the land, saith the Lord, and work, for I am with you, saith the Lord of hosts." How many times, it'd be neat, you may want to do this, I suggest this to you in your study, take that back and look at that exhortation, how many times that occurs in the Old Testament, "Be ye strong." Right? Remember, it was an exhortation that came that Moses gives to Joshua. It was an exhortation from David to Solomon. So you find there are many, many instances of this, of continue on, don't let down the work, stay with it, be courageous. Good exhortation to us. Be strong in the work of the Lord. And then the encouragement of the presence of the Lord, that He will be with them. Okay. Oh, come on. Okay. The outlook for the future in 2, 6, and 9. In a future day, God is going to shake the earth. There may be something of an allusion here to a past time when Israel came out of Egypt, to the shaking that occurred. Psalm 68:8, 77:16, and Exodus 15. All of those make reference to a trembling of the earth and a shaking that God did when Israel, when they came out of Egypt. Okay. Now, these events, we're told, are going to be fulfilled in the millennial kingdom, that God is going to do a shaking. And when you get on over reading in other passages, the tribulation time precedes the millennial kingdom and all that's going to occur there, that's going to be a lot of shaking of the earth, believe me. Okay. Now, this is a phrase that appears here on the desired of all nations. And I will shake all nations, and the desire of all nations shall come. That's been interpreted many times as a reference to Christ. Maybe. Okay. Others feel not. And part of it is in the translation, and that it in terms of the just the literal translation of the Hebrew words there and agreement in terms of the syntax with what goes with it. The pronouns and the pronoun references, that it doesn't really support a reference to a person. Okay, and though it may be, there's again differences here in interpretation. Most of the scholars, sound people, good people, do not think it's a reference, that this is a specific reference to Christ here, though he is talking of the millennial kingdom. And most think that it is a reference to tribute, and that the better translation for all nations would be the precious things of all nations, which would refer to tribute that would be brought, notes that the tabernacle was originally furnished with wealth that came out of Egypt, so not from the Israelites themselves. Solomon's temple was tribute secured by David from those who were in subjection to him. So this is the idea that that comes from other countries. Then in Isaiah 60, let's read that just to get that. Someone want to read that for me, Isaiah 60. And we'll read just a few verses there, especially maybe just 4 and 5. Are you there, Ed?
Yes.
Okay.
Lift up thine eyes round about and see, all they gather themselves together. They come to thee, thy son shall come from far, and thy daughter shall be nursed at thy side. Then thou shalt see and flow together, or be radiant, and thine heart shall fear and be enlarged, because the abundance of the sea shall be converted or turned unto thee. The forces or the wealth of the Gentiles shall come unto thee.
Okay.
The multitude of the camels shall cover thee.
Mm-hmm.
Goes on.
Yeah, the wealth of the Gentiles coming unto thee. And many think that's what is being referred to here in verse 7, the desire of all nations. And one of the arguments that's made is that the Lord is not, that the nations do not desire the Lord. They don't desire His presence. That the Gentile peoples and people as a whole aren't really eagerly looking for the Lord. So that's another argument that's made that deals with this particular analysis. The real glory there will not be material, but the presence of the Lord. The Lord will be glorified in that place, and He is going to give peace there as well. His glory is what is central. Verse 9, the glory of this latter house, which is going to the millennial house here, shall be greater than of the former. And now this connection, notice, and this is what I've kind of been referring to, is this linkage. Because we know that Solomon's temple was destroyed. And then what do we have with the this temple? Well, it's replaced by Herod's temple. And then so we have succeeding temple and destruction. But there seems to be a linkage with each of these that goes right on into the millennial kingdom. And that the Lord is talking about. So there is a glory connected with all of this. This is in the same line. And even though it may not physically be the same building, it is nevertheless in that process of a place that the Lord desires to be among His people in connection with the nation of Israel, and a place where He has picked to put His name among them. So, the future glorious temple is a continuation of this one. Boy, what encouragement that had to be for these people. This may be small, little, almost insignificant in comparison, but it's part of this, of what is going to be a glorious temple. It's going to culminate in the grand design of God. Then we look at the promised blessing. Present ceremonial defilement. Note the date. Rather appropriate. Getting fairly close. Maybe that's why I'm doing this in December. Is that it, Sam? Okay, you checked on this ahead of time. That's what it was. That's what I thought. Okay. The year's off just a tad, but okay. December 18, 520. And he asks questions here concerning righteousness and defilement. Two key principles that are brought out in verses 10 through 12 and in verses 13 through 14. And these have to do with Levitical defilement and contamination. And so he goes back to the Levitical law. And the reference is... let me get this. There we go. They had adopted a mindset that association with holy things makes one holy. So in essence, if we are working with the temple and are building the temple, then there's a rub-off on us that comes, and that's going to make us what we ought to be. Well, then Haggai goes and he looks at this from the Levitical principle that was there. If that which was holy touched something else, did it make it holy? They were carrying the holy meat, okay, the sacrificial meat. The garment that may have been in, that they were using to carry, the cloth that they were carrying that in, was holy. But if it touched something else, it didn't make that holy. And so that's what he asked them. He says, does that work? Is there a carryover effect from this? And their answer was, no, it does not carry over. So just being touched by or in proximity with doesn't do it. Okay? Lots of good lessons there, isn't there? Being around somebody who's a godly person doesn't make you godly. Being in a godly family doesn't make you godly. Being around Christians doesn't make anybody a Christian. Going to church, gathering at the assembly, doesn't make you anything. That's all. Except there. That's all. So there's no just rubbing off on this to make you something else. Righteousness doesn't rub off. It may refer, what he has in mind here, may refer to an earlier period when the people were trying to worship without obeying. In other words, going through a worship process. Or it may refer to the offer of help from the Samaritans here, of incorporating this and some of the righteousness rubbing off here on them. Ceremonial defilement. The righteousness is not contagious, but wickedness is. Isn't that interesting? You know? He uses, again, the example from the Levitical principles. And Leviticus 7, and a number of verses 7 and 22. And the idea of pollution, and if the priest touched something that was polluted, then he was polluted. Okay? So he was unclean. And the other people as well. If they were touched a dead body, they were unclean. So the uncleanness could be transmitted. Now, again, our associations, that affects us in the way we think, what we watch, what we take in, etc. All of that is going to affect the way we think, the way we act, what we do, the people that we run with, all of that. You know? So there is definitely association that is there. They had polluted themselves with self-centeredness through their wrong priorities and by being too accepting of ungodly assistance here from the Samaritans. Present judgment and discipline, a rebuke of the people from the beginning of the post-exilic experience, God had judged because of their selfishness. There was no change of heart until the message of Haggai. In other words, for 16 years, they had struggled for no reason. You know, for 16 years, we've been spinning our wheels. For 16 years, things haven't been going well. For 16 years, there's been frustration. You know? Wasted 16 years. And we could have been about the business the Lord wanted us to be about. How sad. How sad. Some of the prospects for the people here. The past has produced hardship. For the future, there's going to be blessing. In verses 18 and 19 of chapter 2. Let's just turn over and look at that. Consider now, from this day and upward, from the 24th day of the ninth month, even from the day that the foundation of the Lord's temple was laid, consider it. Is the seed yet in the barn? Yet the vine and fig tree and the pomegranate and the olive tree hath not brought forth. From this day will I bless you. So here is the promise of blessing. It's difficult to interpret the reference there to the laying of the foundation of the temple and what the Lord is referring to. Maybe because the dates just simply don't correlate with that foundation, or whether he's talking about perhaps when they first got back and tried to lay the foundation of the temple, but nothing went well. So there may have been a start and then a restart and a second laying of the foundation, or a continuation of the laying of the foundation. But again, it's not completely clear. And in any case, what he is saying is that from this point on, there will be blessing. As, of course, God promised in line with the Old Testament covenant relationship with his people. In that covenant relationship, remember, God associated particular blessing that the heavens would provide rain, their crops would flourish, etc., if they were obedient unto him. And when they weren't obedient, the bad things would happen. So, in other words, there's very definitely temporal correlation to their attitude of heart and their behavior. So God is saying, now you're on the right track, stay there, and the blessings are going to come down. Now, let's make sure this is in a special relationship to Israel. God is not saying that to us. God is not saying, hey, you get your heart right, and you're really living for the Lord, that, boy, your crops are going to flourish, your money's going to grow, your house is going to get bigger, you're going to have the fanciest car in town. That's not what he is saying at all. So don't get a wealth and prosperity gospel out of this. This was a unique promise to covenant people that God promised the result of their spiritual devotion to him, there would be temporal blessing upon them as a nation. That is not a correlation to us, the church. I mean, look at the Apostle Paul. If you want one simple example, you know. And yet Paul said, I have all and abound. He was in prison when he said it. I have everything. Who could want any more than what I have? Well, let's see. I could start ticking off these things. No, Paul said, I've got it all. I've got it all right here. Because I'm in the place where the Lord wants me to be, doing what he wants me to do. You know? And that's the spiritual blessing. So ours is not going to be a material blessing. Ours is a spiritual blessing. So when our hearts are right and we're involved in doing what the Lord wants us to do, there's going to be blessing, but it's not necessarily going to be that our crops are going to flourish and that all of our investments will grow. It's going to be a spiritual blessing that is there inside. Zerubbabel, the chosen one, date, the same as the previous message. And here in verses 20 through 22, verse 21, saying, I will shake the heavens and the earth, a reminder of what he had already prophesied earlier. I'm going to overthrow the throne of kingdoms. I will destroy the strength of the kingdoms of the heathen. I will overthrow the chariots and those that ride in them. And the horses and their riders shall come down, every one, by the sword of his brother. So here is judgment that is going to take place. It is a judgment and a shattering defeat of all nations who are hostile to the rule of God. There's going to be divine deliverance in verse 23. I will take thee, O Zerubbabel, my servant, the son of Shealtiel, and will make thee as a signet, for I have chosen thee, saith the Lord of hosts. Now, this is what I started on earlier, kind of jumping ahead. Zerubbabel, to be God's signet ring. These promises to Zerubbabel. How is that fulfilled? Zerubbabel doesn't continue on. He doesn't get a place of prominence. I mean, he dies off of the scene. But here, I think, really the connection, the signet ring of God, notice he is referred to here as servant, not as governor, which is an interesting elevation. That's messianic language when God is talking about servant here. And it is a servant, and he speaks of the Messiah, the servant of Jehovah. And so he is utilizing a messianic language in referring to him as a servant. And the signet ring, I think a is significant because of its reference back to Jehoiakim and the curse. And remember Jehoiakim? Because of his wickedness that God said to him, none of your descendants will ever sit on the throne of your father David. So an absolute direct block coming down through Jehoiakim for anyone ever sitting on a future throne of David. And he had referred to Jehoiakim in that same reference as a signet. Though he wore a signet ring on my finger. You know, yes, this is going to happen. And now what does he say here to Zerubbabel? I will make thee as a signet. I have chosen thee, saith the Lord of hosts. Well, God is going to fulfill. I'll get there. Come on. Now a sign of hope for fulfillment of the Davidic covenant, the Davidic promise. He doesn't say exactly how he's going to do it, and I don't think Zerubbabel knew how he was going to do it. But here is that encouragement that that line of prophecy, the Messiah is going to come, and he does come, and he does have the right. It is through, all of you know this, but through Joseph and through Mary, Mary's line, goes back through Nathan to David and bypasses the curse on Jehoiakim, or Jeconiah, as also he is called. And the line through Joseph goes back here through Zerubbabel, all the way right on back through Jeconiah, Jehoiakim, and right on back to David. That was the legal right to the throne. So in Mary and Joseph, we have combined the legal right to the throne through Joseph, but no bloodline. Bloodline, because Christ is virgin born of Mary. So there is no bloodline going back through Joseph, but there is a legal line going back to the throne. There is a bloodline that goes directly back to David through Mary. So he has the bloodline, the royal blood of David, but he has the legal right through Joseph, and it violates. So the encouraging word here to Zerubbabel, that yes, the messianic promise, even though the curse of Jehoiakim is on your lineage, nevertheless, the messianic promises will be completely fulfilled. So, this little day, this temple, all of what's going on, small in your eyes, but great in the eyes of God, and God is going to bring it to fruition in what we're looking forward to, still yet, some future date. I don't believe that. No. What is that? Right at 12 o'clock. Wow! Wow!